what are you saying about Centigrade 233, let's keep with that title, about Fahrenheit 451? Does the book live? Does the book need to be somehow re-envisioned? I mean, not to rewrite Bradbury, but to make the book relevant, if that's the word, for future generations?
All the other methods of presenting art, science, and so forth are evolving, particularly along the visual axis, because we get so much information visually. I mean, the eyes are not really in any sense independent of the brain. They're so closely integrated. By the time information gets to your brain from your eyes, it's already been a great deal of processing done on the way along the optic nerve. So print books generally must evolve too. And of course, it always does. I mean, we like Jane Austen novels and so forth. It was written in a different time and place, and they're written very well, but there are many, many ways to tell that story. And sometimes visually is better. Certainly, I think visually is better for conversation, because you get tone of voice instead of just the words on the page. So much nuance is conveyed beyond the written word. The written word has a nice solidity to it, but it's just one of the ways.
But when Francois Truffaut gives us images of people walking back and forth in a semi-trance, reciting the books they have memorized, right, that bothered me a little.
It goes back to the Odyssey, which, let's remember, was conveyed forward for centuries by memorization before they had written language at all. So we know that texts can survive a long time. If they're important enough, they will be memorized. The thing you don't realize reading the Odyssey in English is, in the original Greek, apparently, it rhymed, which is the only way to make something last a long time, is the rhyme keeps you suggesting the next line. And so that was the invention of song, too. That's why songs rhyme, because you can remember them better that way. And we're back to Frost again.
But as they recite these books, they memorize them and recite them in days to come, they will change. Can the prose of a Dickens or a Bradbury, the prose style now, can that survive the changes of endless retellings?
Well, there's always a transcription error problem if you're doing it orally alone. But I would point out Borges' story about about the guy who could reconstruct portions of Don Quixote.
Oh, yes.
Because he immersed himself in the time so he could go into a trance and get into the same state of mind and so write portions of Don Quixote, which is a supreme feat of creation, to have immersed himself in the past so much that he can literally create exactly the same thing.
But retain himself.
But retain himself. But the point is, you see, that Borges wrote this satirically, because it's a satirical view of the originality thesis. My God, what a supreme feat to do exactly what was done. And you know it's true because he gets exactly the same words. That's the fetish of authenticity.
Do you want your books to be memorized and recited to future generations?
No. I'd prefer that they be inscribed in large type on the sides of mountains.
Then we can have people stumbling across these marks on the walls, yes, like in the stories.
I would prefer granite, if you don't mind, not that messy sandstone that everybody else is using.
Well, we're going to have to get out of here. Is there a question that you've always wanted to be asked during an interview but somehow never comes up?
Where are the drinks? a question.
I never get anywhere with a question like that, as a matter of fact. People say no.
I can't. There's no particular question I would like to be asked. I mean, if I want to say something, I just say it anyway. I can use any pretext. So where's all this work going to appear?
Okay, well, I'm going to
be another great book like
I'm going to contact the Journal of the Fantastic and the Arts, for one thing. I know people there, and I've published on Straub there before. And at the same time, I'm working on a radio. That's why I'm having you read some of these quotes. And I'm going to submit it to the public radio station here to see maybe where it goes. I've had good luck sometimes getting into the national platform. So whatever I transcribe is going to come to you first. And as far as any of the vocal stuff goes, well, I'm always apologizing for ambient sound, and I just don't even do it anymore. I think ambient sound is pretty terrific sometimes.
It's fine, the occasional babble of...
Yeah, unless it's when I interviewed a great violinist named Aaron Rosand, and there was a waterfall at the far end of the hotel lobby, and it was a monsoon on the tape.
Because it... probably, if it was a curved wall, then it was acoustic focusing on you, and you didn't notice it.
No. Okay, a last quote, 60 seconds maybe. Mentalities cannot persist without the rub of the real.
Yes. The rub of the real. I always like alliteration. And the rub of the real is, that must be from Time's Rub, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you quote it also. In, I don't know where you quoted.
In Time Shards?
Page 592.
Oh.
The rub of the real.
Right. The rub of the real is the feeling that I deal in abstractions. I mean, my first part of my career is primarily a mathematical physicist. Yeah. So I'm always instructed by the rub of the real because it reminds you that mathematics is enormously powerful, but it is an abstraction. And the world is messy, and or as another character of mine occasionally says, nature bats last. I've always liked short summaries of ideas, and nature bats last is one of my favorite. The other element is that behind Time's Rub is what's called Newcomb's Paradox, which I think is explained, somewhere or other.
Well, I heard of it, but you'll have to...
Newcomb's Paradox is, I can't recite entirely, but it's about placing a bet based on a prediction made by a superhuman intelligence, and what's the smart way to make the bet. And Newcomb made it up, but never published it, but he told people about it. It became so well-known, it became a logical paradox, and there have books been written about it. But I went back and, because I knew Bill Newcomb, I published a number of papers with him. He was a theoretical physicist at Livermore when I was a postdoc for Ed Teller and then a staff member. So I never really had any other solution to it, and Newcomb himself didn't really have a solution. He just thought it was an interesting paradox. But about 6 years ago, I was talking to a mathematician about it, and we realized that there's a way to confront it using a piece of mathematics that I barely knew. And so we actually analyzed it using this kind of decision theory and found out that the paradox is evaporating. That is, it's not actually a paradox. If you frame the paradox in English, there is an infomeme, which you know is a syllogism with a missing middle.
Okay.
That's a Greek term, which no one seems to remember. And so if you unpack the sentence, you realize there's an assumption hidden in it. And if you do go into an actual calculation of decision theory, there's a point where you have to make a judgment. And so you get two different answers depending on how you make this judgment. I can't go into any more detail, but what we did was show that the paradox doesn't exist if you do it mathematically. And that's a good example of how mathematics can tell you something that language, with its sloppiness and slipperiness, cannot, because it's not logical. But if you do formal logic on it, then you can see that it's not actually a problem.
But somehow you have mastered both like kinds of languages.
Right. Well, I started out being good at mathematics, and I realized that was a thing that I could exploit. I remember in high school when I could easily learn calculus, and everybody else was saying, gee whiz, this is really tough. It was the first year that calculus was taught in U.S. high schools, public high schools. It was 1958, when my brother and I went back to school in Dallas, Texas, and the results of what turned out to be later the SAT exams had just come through, and both he and I had perfect scores in both categories. But this is post-Sputnik, and the U.S. government was so lean and mean then that from Sputnik, October of 57, to opening of school in September of 58, the U.S. government had a whole new high school curriculum drawn up by a team at MIT in science and mathematics and deployed into public schools so that many schools debuted an advanced physics course, a true calculus course of 1 year's duration, which had just simply not been there in public education. And bam, we walked in the front door and were given our classes. And here were courses we didn't even know were there before. Plus the fact that we were in them because we had done so well on this exam. First such exam I ever took, except for an IQ test. And I realized that I was really good at this, so I just decided, you know, well, I'm going to bang on this drum. And so I decided to become a theoretical physicist. Also, though, I'd read Laura Fermi's biography of her husband, Enrico Fermi, and I realized what it was like to be a physicist, and it instantly convinced me that that's what I wanted to do. And I did, and so did my brother. We both have PhDs from UCSD.
And what does he do? Is he a teacher?
No. He has always been entrepreneurial in the private section. He did research in industrial places like Physics International, and he started his own company, Microwave Sciences, which has done very well. He's the world's best-known expert on high-power microwaves.
Well, not to be maudlin about it, but you're lucky to still have your twin. Because you lose your twin.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
I know. How old were you when he died?
I'm 68 now. This was back in 1950 or 2002. I'll let you do the math.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife died that year. What month?
Oh, this is April.
March for John. March 25. Yeah.
I think it's one of the reasons I like Schumann so much, because he is very much involved in the dual personality, the splitting of self, all of that stuff in his music.
Oh, he's the king of sadness, the sultan of sadness, I should say.
But I'll tell you, there are moments of triumph in that music that are wonderful.
Oh, there are.
I hope you will give that a listen.
Oh, certainly I will. I will, maybe I'll do so in flight. Yeah, I can just play it on my laptop.
And I can't thank you enough for your time. Mm. This has been a kick.
Oh, it's fun to get to talk. and this is nice, because this is an invitation to go to the longevity thing. They're paying me to go, paying all my expenses and $1,000. And I thought, hey, I can go to KU too, or UK, and see people here, because I haven't been here in a long time. And from here, I'm going to Oak Ridge to stay with an old friend and get a tour of the place and give a talk.
How did it come about then? You came to KU because of the Kansas City gig?
Yeah.
Some people knew about that.
Right. It's at the what's it called?
Linda Hall Library.
But I also got an invitation to speak at Vanderbilt in the physics department, because the chairman of the department there had started writing science fiction, and he wrote to me about it and said, how would you like to come? And so I'm going to give the talk I'm going to give today, but I'll give in more detail. I will give at Vanderbilt in the physics department on the physics of and economics of
the talk this afternoon.
Yeah.
And you're doing something at 11:30. I'm going to get you over there.
Oh, yeah. What time is it?
It's almost 11:15.
Geez, we better go.
Well, I will thank you.